This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 4th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Persol.
Hello and welcome to edition 287 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol, here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Rob Bound.
Coming up in today's show. The history of the English and Ireland people shaped through centuries of conquest, law, literature and more. We're joined by one author who recounts this nation's turbulent and multifaceted makeup through stories, images and memories in his new book.
Then we learn about the story of the Old Vic, one of the greatest theatres not just in London, but perhaps the world.
And finally... we hear about Hollywood's prospects for 2015 and ask a prominent film critic and journalist why the year is bringing so many big blockbuster sequels.
All that plus, of course, our look ahead to the stories that are sure to set the news agenda at the start of this new year. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly, and it's here on Monocle 24.
Happy New Year, Andrew.
Happy New Year. You look much fresher than you did at the end of last year.
Well, oh, you know, there was a strange thing. At the end of last year, I feel like we did quite a lot of... We were squeezed into Studio One quite a lot often, weren't we, together?
Yes.
Not that we didn't... Not that wasn't a pleasant place to be, and not that it wasn't a pleasant person to be with, but I got a bit cabin fever. She got a bit studioed out at the end of 2014. 2015, Happy New Year and all that. I feel great. I'm raring to go.
Good. Well, we have a fine and dandy show lined up for us.
We're kind of going back to the future, I believe.
We're going back to the future.
First of all, we're talking about the history of England. No small thing.
And written by a gentleman who actually is a professor of French history. Oh, that'll be interesting. we're going to test him. No, actually, I think he's going to test us. Turns out, actually, he knows everything.
I think he does know everything.
Good.
I'm looking forward to it. How was your head? How were your New Year celebrations?
It's all been fine and dandy. As you say, it was nice to kind of just stop, hang up the stocking, get some gifts, and here we are again.
I don't think we need too long of an introduction, do we? Because I think 2015 is going to be the year of the short, sharp introduction. Without further ado, let's bring out the newsman himself. Here is Tom Edwards.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest-hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much. We literally have to change it. We've laughed about that one rubbish joke all year, even though it's my joke, it's quite good.
I think it's still funny, and I'm the butt of the joke.
Happy New Year.
How's 2015 shaping up?
Maybe you can tell us, actually. That was what we were rather hoping, wasn't
but
it?
But in the early days.
The first 4 days have been excellent. Of it.
Have you crested any new heights?
That's a really personal question.
Sorry. So I've got to stop doing that, which is when I first start speaking to people.
Yeah.
That was on my resolutions list. I've just scrubbed that one out straight away.
Tell us, what lies ahead?
We've got a few things. I thought we'd do a bit of a broad brush because, you know, keep it kind of loose. Political, some key political happenings. I like to cast my news net far and wide, as you know. Politically, the thing that I'm probably most excited about is a domestic political election, general election here in the UK.
Whether your girlfriend will be elected mayor of your house.
Oh, that coup happened long ago.
There's a 99% chance and a 1% turnout.
Exactly. Yeah. I remain a don't know. British, the general election in May, of course. It's usually sort of first week or so of May. I think it's the 7th. It's quite interesting to look at a bit of a sea change we've had since the coalition government here in this country. Intriguingly, it seems that the Conservatives and Labour have both completely lost ground and lost the kind of authority and their appeal to the electorate in broad terms. So we've always had this very, very structured two-party system, and yet it seems much more fragmented. And I think people are talking about, you know, the involvement of these, you know, nutcases like UKIP on one side or whatever. But it's just a lot more fractured than it's ever been. And I think it'll be really interesting to see, you know, see what happens.
Well, the Liberal Democrats aren't doing that well either. So it's Nigel Farage's party and the SNP, which seem to be the wild cards. Will they hold the balance of power in an election? Just before Christmas, I went to an event where I spoke to a very famous pollster, and I was quizzing him about what he felt that would be the outcome of the UK election. And he just said it really is probably too difficult to call in any real sense for the first time in many, many years. We cannot guess how the votes will fall.
I think it's a generational shift in terms of people's attitude to politics, and whether that's because the way that work has changed people's relationship with parties that were traditionally aligned on the basis of, you know, people's professions or their, you know, their very immediately with their sort of social class. It's all much more looser. The boundaries are all really blurred. So I think it's interesting, you know, socio-politically.
I think there was something I heard before Christmas, people saying that there's a possibility, a real possibility, that the Conservative Party might, if they have to form a coalition, refuse to and then just call another election and say, well, what do you really want?
Which is
nuts, isn't it?
Exactly.
To be in power, they could be in power as a minority government for a month or two and then just call another general election.
It's been a sort of a badge of honour, I guess, in Britain about electoral stability. The fact that it hasn't been, you know, hosts of elections, there hasn't been this very varied system. You know, we seemed to be a country, traditionally at least, that liked to have, you know, blocks of power, and yet, as the pollsters and everyone else is saying, it doesn't look like that could happen again this time.
Well, that's looking quite a way ahead.
Yeah.
That's good.
How about even further ahead?
It's going to happen this evening.
On the other side, well, no one knows. US primaries as well, looking ahead to 2016, which is a bit previous. But the primaries begin obviously this year.
Yep.
Lots of interesting things. But, you know, but we talk about, you know, political wild cards in this country. What about Jeb Bush?
Yeah.
Could we see the Bush dynasty back in the White
and
House
also
again?
Florida, an interesting battleground for Jeb Bush. He's the governor of Florida, you know, with Cuba opening up and all the rest of it. That's going to be an interesting battleground as well, right?
That's it. Well, I think people always remember, you know, these sort of dark moments, if you like, where there was controversy, of course, about what happened in the sort of, you know, Floridian part of the electoral process. But I just think it would be such an interesting marker for the US if, after a two-term Obama Democrat administration, it was then, you know, another of the Bush family. I just think I find those political dynasties compelling, and you almost want it to happen just so you can compare and contrast.
It could be a Clinton versus Bush again.
Isn't that extraordinary?
It seems to
contract always, the amount of time it takes for these to cycle through these political
and the strange thing is, if we were watching, say, you know, Russia, and it was like one family passing the baton between each other, you'd think it was a bit kind of dodgy and corrupt. But oddly, in the US, it just goes, oh, yeah, that's the way it happens.
Yeah.
There's only one family knows how to do this.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Of the hundreds of millions of people and all of that wealth and all of that political wealth.
Well, it's a strange thing. The trick of transparency is very well done in America. Let's face it.
It's quite profound. It's quite meaty. I like
it. So that's 2015. You know, it's all right.
That's
starts you mean to go on.
Well, you mentioned Russia there, Andrew, and I thought, you know, it's worth mentioning Vladimir Putin, who's been very much, you know, sort of one of the kind of villains of the piece, certainly in the last 12 months. And I know that in Forecast, of course, Monocle's sort of Look Ahead magazine, we talk about Steve Bloomfield goes to Kazakhstan, a place Putin claims has no sense of nationhood, and that's got people worried that his sort of, you know, fiddling around the borders of, you know, the former sort of Soviet bloc, you know, could continue. Maybe that's another really interesting ground to look at in 2015. You know, what will happen in the sort of periphery of the old Soviet Union?
Yes, the nationalist card is ever more important, and it is always, as we're saying, wild card. There is a wild card. You never know how he's going to play it, because you don't play it for rational reasons. You play it for provoking, you know, your home electorate and for trying to garner support by being outspoken and belligerent and difficult, and so you can't do the rational thing in many occasions.
It's interesting stuff.
We're quite serious, aren't we?
It's a bit serious. Well, I was going to do another serious thing, but I won't do that.
No, it's fine.
Well, no, I think if we look to sort of, Southeast Asia and Far East, some of the things that are going to be important, building up to sort of APEC meeting in Manila, right, I think in November of this year. It'll be a thriller in Manila.
Oh,
the ASEAN, it's all about economic integration. It's interesting, you know, you look at the sort of tensions within Europe, the rise of populism, rise of the right. The idea is that this could all happen by the end of 2015, by 31st of December. And I think it will be something that very much defines the political agenda and the geopolitical agenda throughout that region all through the year. You know, will that integration happen by year's end. My suspicion is that it won't, but there'll certainly be a lot of meetings and a lot of talk about it. And it's just interesting to look at how, you know, nations do or do not work well together for the sort of greater good, if you like.
Is there going to be another big conference somewhere where there's lots of trees? A rumble in the jungle.
That is good.
That's what I
want. That is good. Early gag of the year. I wonder about a couple of other slightly different things. You know, we won't just be talking about, you know, geopolitics and big economic issues. Look at things like, you know, Maison et Objet launching in its Miami version, sort of in the
yeah.
In
so
the
this is the home design and the kind of gift fair, which is actually a huge thing with like so many stores and people go to buy kind of great design from around the world. It's not quite, you know, it's not the Milan Furniture Fair, but it's a really intriguing thing with this kind of rolled out formats now around the world. It's headed east and now it's heading
west. Well, and it's interesting that if you look at the Americas, you know, was there a great trade fair for this kind of sector? You know, maybe not. Maybe this is a bit long overdue. To
you love Maison et Objet because you got to go there and
well, that's what I'm tilting for. Basically,
that's who you're going to Paris.
This is
and
my
you sat
pitch.
There, kind of like, chatting to people about kind of their nice wooden toys.
Well, it's a pretty agreeable way to spend
actually,
the time.
I wouldn't. I mean, I'm very happy to do that one. I don't think my Art Basel honeymoon was long enough. I think I need to go back to Miami.
Second honeymoon,
yeah,
a few months later.
On,
well, it's right. In May. Pencil it in. Why
yeah,
not?
And some Maison et Objet, great place to put down a wedding list. Right.
Absolutely. I think you've had your wedding, Rob Bowden. That's all done.
And then, you know, but again, it's kind of light and shade. So there's also great sporting fixtures of the year. It's funny, you get these off years actually in the world of sport. So, you know, you have the years when, like in 2012, you have the Olympics, you have to wait for 2016, you wait for the even numbers, Football World Cup, sort of in the companion even year. It's going to be a vintage one in 2015, but there is, for egg chasers, there's the rugby World Cup. There is
the Ashes.
Oh, and the Ashes, of course, yeah. Which is pretty good. Yeah. Oh, so maybe it could be a vintage one after all.
Yeah. Well, I think this is also, it's quite nice when there aren't these mega occasions, and the smaller things get to get to be good and they get to be appreciated as good rather than just being sort of background noise. You know.
And well. You've forgotten the West Sussex Country Fair.
Yeah, the Rare Breeds Show. That's what yeah.
Do that, yeah, I not include the cheese rolling?
There's cheese rolling.
No, that's not part of, yeah.
We love cheese rolling. We love barrel rolling.
I'm definitely rolling. I'm definitely going to do an outside broadcast on the Rare Breeds Show this year. It's absolutely brilliant. It's a film.
You heard it here first, people.
It's a film in that.
I want
sure.
to put you in a barrel, roll you down a hill.
I'll give it a bash. Why not? I like the. What was the one where the barrels are actually full of? You know, then everyone drinks on the route, and I think it was in. Was it well, in the, a small? The, was it in Piedmont or somewhere? I can't remember where it was.
Do you mean the barrel carrying thing? The burning tar barrel carrying.
Oh,
it's in Ottery St Mary in Dorset.
Oh, that sounds dangerous. Actually, I don't think I should go.
It's terrifying.
And there was you had the uppers and downies at the end of last year. I think we should do like a weird sport of the week.
And send
you out to do it and see how many bones are broken by like March.
How can you be completely paralysed after about a fortnight?
Most of these are dangerous, aren't they?
They are, exactly. I have to review my insurance conditions.
Well, actually, we should remember last year you had to go and play football, didn't you? Five-a-side football with Tom Reynolds.
This is New Year, come on, we've moved on.
You couldn't walk on the next day.
Well, I gave it my best shot.
You were hitting in between the goalposts, weren't you?
It was a twin strike to face and swingers in consecutive strikes.
And Tom Reynolds, who we often talk about, who sits near us.
He looked after me so well. No, he didn't. He completely ignored me and just mocked me and then came in and told everyone about it. What kind of a friend is that?
Oh, Tom Reynolds.
I think you need to wear a box. Yeah. 2015, year of the box.
That's it. Again, we've coined it right here.
Tick.
Okay.
Tom, thank you so much. I can't wait for another year of wonderful news look aheads. If they're as good as that one was, it's going to be a vintage 2015. Thank you very much.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
The The English people are amongst the oldest in the world when it comes to having an identity. Even before this country had a name, the kinship and shared ideals of its people were already being formed.
Although we've evolved immensely since the times of invasion and conquest, apparently, we can still trace back a long and continuous history of the English people.
Well, you don't have to trace it back yourself because luckily someone else already did. Joining us now in the studio is Robert Toombs, Professor of History at Cambridge University and author of The English and Their History. And we should say, first of all, Robert, this is a really mighty book that covers a huge expanse of history. How long has this endeavour been? And what was the ambition really in setting out to produce such a kind of a wonderful sweep of history?
Well, it took a lot of weekends and evenings over about the last 6 years. It's been my main occupation apart from teaching since then. The idea was that we were facing up to a new period in our history. The English, on the whole, haven't had to think very much about who they are or what they are. We thought of ourselves as British and European and so on, and before that as imperial. But it was pretty clear a few years back, of course it's even clearer now, that that's not going to be how we are in future. That England's facing some decisions. And it seemed to me about 6 years ago it was a good time to write a history.
And was your shuffling of history and your looking back over events, that you look at how we brought in kings from other countries to rule us, how other invasions happened, well, not for a long time, but were you trying to show that actually the English have been quite good at adapting, at kind of taking on different cultures and still staying very English?
Yeah, I suppose we've had little choice in the matter. The kings, it's true, at least one king was brought in. That was William of Orange in 1688. But most kings have come in without the by your leave of the people of England. But yeah, I suppose we've living in an island, having established fairly early some sense of identity meant, yeah, I think we've been able to put up with quite a lot. But we've been very lucky, and that's one of the main themes of the book. If you think of the experiences of most of the human race, we have to, I think, accept that we've been among the luckiest, partly because of where we are, on an island near a continent, partly protected by the sea and also but connected by the sea with the rest of the world quite easily. So we've been occupying one of the most desirable bits of the planet, I suppose, and so we've been, on the whole, a pretty rich and well-governed and lucky people. Which for me is not something that we ought to be too complacent about. It really rather makes me wonder why we're not doing rather better than we are today.
It's an interesting, it's a fascinating thing that by a luck of geography almost, or by luck of topography, we're in the present state, or we were in a present state in a golden age. Looking through all the hundreds of years within the pages of your book, Robert, which do you see as the golden age? I guess everybody has their favourite, but what's the wise money on?
Well, I don't think there ever is a golden age. That's a kind of dream. We sometimes like to think that there was a time and everything was good. And there never really is. The more you look back at it, there are always problems. There are always people who are suffering. There are always mistakes being made. There are always bad things being done. But I think one of the better times was probably the 18th century, assuming you didn't have toothache or you didn't have any serious diseases and you had enough money, then the 18th century was a pretty good time to be around.
And I wanted to ask you also, I mean, it's a nice title in a way, The English and Their History. Have the English always been interested in their own history, or has there always been a sense of revelling in the mythology of the English? Has that always been part of being English?
Well, it seems to me that we quite like the past. Mm. We quite like visiting old buildings and that kind of thing. I'm not sure that we've ever been all that interested in history as a study. Certainly not really of our own. And maybe that's a good thing. It's better not be too self-obsessed, I think. I don't think many people do it at school. And what they do at school is not very much about England. And it's certainly not about the whole of English history. So I think for people like me writing books occasionally, it's the idea is that there are people who actually want to know a lot more than they do and haven't really had much of an opportunity up to often their mature years to be able to actually find out much about their country.
On that note, it's interesting. Is your book pitched at the person, is it aimed at the reader who doesn't know about English history, or is it a a history book in a sense.
No, it's not a history book in the sense that it's not really written for people who have to read it.
Yeah. Well, you know what I mean. This is not aimed at other professors. This is aimed at the layman.
No, that's exactly what I mean. Because, I'm used to writing books. All academics are for people whose job it is to read other books of history, students or colleagues. And this is certainly not for them. It's meant the first book I've ever wholly written for people who are not professionals. So it's written for people like you, basically, and people like those listening to this programme, I hope.
And tell me, one of the things that's interesting, although we may not have been invaded many times, and although we've been this island, England has been much shaped by its relationship with other countries, whether through empire, the great period of empire, or the Second World War. But what's intriguing is that your day job is a professor of history, but French history. Did that kind of understanding of that relationship, even across the channel, how people looked back on England and saw it in a different light, was that informative for you writing this book about what it meant to be English?
Yes, very much so, though I don't think I realised quite how much till the book was finished and people started asking me about it. But it means that I've always thought of England within a wider context. I think it's a great temptation when you're writing the history of any country to think of nothing else but that place, as if it's unique, as if it's sort of living on its in its own little planet. But of course, we're not. We're constantly connected with others, and I'm sort of constantly comparing this country with its neighbours and with others. So I try to keep up a sort of comparative perspective, and also I think it meant that I came to it new. To be honest, I hadn't actually studied English history since my first year at university, and I knew very little about it, so I spent a lot of time reading and talking to other people. And I hope it gave me a kind of fresh approach, and it certainly gave me the nerve to try to do it.
Although I do see from one of the reviews you've fallen into that big debate about are the French as clean as the English, with a question about how much soap the French used and how much soap the English used.
Yeah, I don't know why I picked on the French there. But yes, it apparently was the case in the 19th century that the English used, I can't remember how much it was now, 12 pounds of soap a year, and the French only used 6. And I comment, or at least I quote a German historian at the time as saying the English confuse soap with civilization. But of course, in the 19th century, people lived in dirty towns, and they were really determined to live, as we probably remember from the days of our grandparents or great grandparents, if we have a long memory, that people were very keen on being clean and cleaning their houses, and sunlight soap was the first ever great consumer item.
Just diving into your book today, that it does seem on most pages you've found some nugget, a gem of information which illuminates the period, perhaps more than just the thrust of the narrative. Is that important to you, that when you're researching these books, that you find something that kind of brings it home to people, a little nugget? And I wonder if there are any others that kind of struck you as you were compiling the book.
Yeah, well, that's quite a lot. But yeah, I had a lot of fun writing it, and I intended to enjoy it, and I did. And I hope that people will enjoy reading it. But yeah, I think it's very, very important to make things as concrete as you can, and not just to give a sort of an abstract description. So yeah, there are lots of stories of all periods about. Well, I mean, one, I'm not sure if I dare mention this over the air.
Oh,
but,
you please do. Especially me and Rob.
As we know,
it's only us.
We know that offences for crimes were pretty severe right up until nearly our own time. And blinding and castrating was a common one for thieves in the early 19th century. And in one case that's recorded, a guy had his next door neighbour done for stealing from his house, which he hadn't actually done. And he actually did the blinding and castrating himself. So imagine that your next door neighbour's going to do it to you.
That's a really, that's brings a whole new angle to vigilantism, doesn't it?
Also the tussles over hedges, they don't seem so bad anymore.
No, I'm sure you get people who'd actually quite like doing that if they got the chance.
And how much does writing play a part in English history? I mean, as a historian, you have to give your book a tone and a narrative thrust. But how important has the English language itself, the evolution of it, and its key practitioners during this last 1,000 years been?
Well, I think crucial. I mean, we after the Norman Conquest, English, although it was always used, it ceased to be the main language of the kingdom. Yeah. You know, the ruling class spoke French, the educated spoke Latin. And it's conceivable that England would have lost that kind of cultural identity. I mean, it came back in the late Middle Ages, partly for political reasons and partly, probably largely for political reasons. And then, you know, there were people who set out quite deliberately to say, you know, the English have to have their own language and a literature, and they have to be able to read the Bible in English and so on. And things like that have been hugely important for the English, but also for every country in which that process was gone through, which, you know, is probably most countries in the world by now. But, you know, the experience of any society which suddenly finds it's got a written language, that its dialects have been written down by someone, they've got a literature, they've got a way of recording their experiences, their culture, their history, that suddenly makes them hugely more of a community. And that happened to us, as it's happened to so many.
I wanted to rush you to the end of the book almost, which is, again, one of the reasons, as you said, you took on the challenge. We're in a really intriguing point in England and many countries in Europe where the question about migration is no longer about the economic pros and cons in a way. It's about a sense of identity and people feeling that their identity is being lost and not sure where they stand in the lineup of people who make up their nation these days. And in the likes of the UK, we have UKIP and Nigel Farage really digging into that notion of what it is to be English. And he's famously said that he doesn't like getting on a bus and listening and no one's speaking the English that he understands. Do you think that our notion of what it is to be English is, under threat is the wrong word, but is...
In flux, maybe.
Yeah, in flux. It's not people are a bit unsure, especially in metropolitan areas. Or actually, I was thinking it was a mistake, because I guess in metropolitan areas we cope with it very well. But some sense that we're not quite sure who we are at the moment.
I think it's inevitable that people will worry. The thing that makes me not worry is that this is something that we've been very used to. You know, if you're Switzerland or Luxembourg or Finland, the influx of a lot of people from other parts of the world is a great cultural shock. Well, for us, it hasn't really been all that much of a one. Okay, we worry about the numbers and we worry about overcrowding and house prices and all that, which are kind of rational fears, I think. I don't think we feel that we're sort of, existentially threatened by people, because we're used to doing this and ourselves travelling an awful lot around the world. So I think we shouldn't be too worried, and we should be fairly confident in our ability to keep our society functioning in a way that makes us all feel part of the same political community. I see no reason why that shouldn't happen.
Well, the book is a beautiful one. It's called The English and Their History. The author is Robert Toombs. At 1,000 pages, not long, not a bad weekends and evenings project. Robert, thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at McGlory House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
The Old Vic, the stage that received Richard III and Hamlet. But as it turns out, drama was not only present in the theatre's stage, but also haunting its backstage and also its management.
Since its opening in 1818, a series of good and bad impresarios have directed the theatre, and a series of scandalous and fabulous actors have graced its stage. Well, joining us on the line now to shine a light on this great institution's history is Terry Coleman, journalist, biographer and author of The Old Vic, the story of a great theatre from Keane to Olivier to Spacey. And Terry, first of all, it's much storied history, presumably. Tell us perhaps where the book came about. I mean, is it a place that's got such an amazing atmosphere it needs to be nailed in a book?
It is, after all, one of the most distinctive theatres in London. I mean, you can think of Covent Garden, you can think of the Haymarket, you can think of Drury Lane. But in fact, then none of them have such a continuous history as the Old Vic. Since the Old Vic was put up in 1818, apart from the time when it was a temperance hall under Emma Cons, it's been, and this is very strange, a sort of classical theatre south of the river.
It's an interesting thing. I wanted to ask you about that. It seems like a bit of an accident of geography that we have the sort of the mother load of the English stage in the West End. And then this guy sits down there just near Waterloo Station on the cut, minding its own business, but also, you know, forming legends and forming its own amazing history.
Well, it was built there, you see, because of Waterloo Bridge, which was built in 1816, after a year after the battle. It was thought, well, people will cross the river to our new theatre, and the new theatre was built. At first did what sort of melodrama like Sweeney Todd, and always did have a sort of raffishness about it. Eliza Vincent, an actress now unknown but then quite famous, was for 15 years, this is about the 1840s, she was either leading lady or the impresario there, which is astonishing. She also has the distinction of being the victim of an attempted murder in the cut. One of her girls, rather discontented, tried to cut her throat.
And tell us the turning point, I guess, for the theatre. You know, an amazing theatre, you know, of course, part of London's history. But I guess the moment when Lillian Bayliss takes over is when it begins to take on a bit of a new direction.
I think there are two things. I think there are two things which save that theatre. The first goes back a bit before Bayliss, goes back to 1871. By then, the theatre was 50 years old and in a shocking state, in a state of collapse. And a man with the splendid name of Romain Delator, an impresario, sort of came from north of the river and thought that he would build south of the river a theatre to rival the Alhambra in Leicester Square. Now this was a quite crazy idea, but he did it. And in 12 weeks, he ripped out the interior of the old theatre and replaced it with the glorious auditorium which is there at the moment. And he did that in 12 weeks. Isn't that astonishing? Incidentally, he lasted about 3 years before he went bankrupt. One of 13, I think, 13 managements of the Old Vic to go bankrupt. But you asked me about Lillian Bayliss, and of course, Lillian Bayliss. Without Lillian Bayliss, the Old Vic, as it exists, simply wouldn't be there. She was a cross between a saint and a monomaniac. And she never gave up. She is and without her, the theatre simply would not have survived. But she has been given credit for importing Shakespeare into the Old Vic and making it famous as a Shakespeare house. It isn't quite true. She didn't want Shakespeare at first. She took over in 19. 12, and an actress called Rosina Philippi came to her and proposed to put on Shakespeare. Miss Bayliss didn't want Shakespeare. However, the Board of Trustees thought they'd try it. And Miss Philippi and Miss Bayliss quarreled bitterly, but Shakespeare was put on. Miss Philippi was allowed to produce only two plays. And then Miss Bayliss, seeing she was on to a good thing, took over. And the astonishing thing was that you would get in a year at the Old Vic something like, let's say, 15 plays by Shakespeare. Isn't that extraordinary?
And presumably, I mean, I think I'm right in saying that Shakespeare was pretty unfashionable at this time. I mean, I don't think it was learnt outside of literature. And maybe it wasn't. Was this the reason that it wasn't in fashion at that time?
Well, I mean, you had a Shakespeare tradition in the West End, but nobody had ever put on a full season of Shakespeare. And here again, you see, there was a great luck. The Old Vic has been a very lucky theatre. In 1914, the first year of the First World War. Who should come along into the theatre and offer his services but a man called Ben Greet. Now, Ben Greet was an actor-manager who for the previous 10 years had been tatting around the United States putting on season after season of Shakespeare at places like Harvard and Yale and the White House and, you know, that sort of thing. Now, he was a naval man, but he was too old then to go back into the Navy. He wanted to do his duty, and he said to Miss Bayliss, "Let me produce Shakespeare for you. I will do it for nothing because it is my duty." Now, how much luckier do you get than that?
The other thing that's, I guess, famous for the Old Vic is that it was the birthplace, really, of Britain's national theatre, a theatre that now sits, you know, only a 2-minute stroll away from the Old Vic.
Good quick walker, Andrew.
I'm very good yeah. Quick walker. How did that come about that it was the birthplace for this, you know, this extraordinary institution?
Yeah, well, I at that time I was arts correspondent of The Guardian, and I covered there the National Theatre at the Old Vic, and I knew Olivier well. Incidentally, he loathed the place, and most of the National Theatre people loathe the place. You see, they have been promised for year after year after year, for something like 30 years at least, they have been promised a new grand National Theatre. And what they wanted was a new theatre. What they were offered, of course, was the Old Vic, which by then was really showing its age, and they really did their best, as it seems to me, to desecrate the place. The gilt sort of inside interior, which is quite beautiful, was all painted over in a sludge green. The proscenium was knocked down. The remaining boxes were taken out. An apron stage was built, which projected so far into the auditorium that Olivier said, "By God, if we project this anymore, the audience will be in the foyers. I'm sorry, the action, the actors will be in the foyer, and the audience will be out in the cut."
Terry, one final question. You talked about the interior of the Old Vic. Is there something about it's a nice theatre to be in? There's something about the size of it that works. You're never too far away from the stage. Neither do you feel like the actors are breathing down upon you from the stage either. Is it something to do with the dimensions of the space that make it such a good theatre as well, such a successful one?
It's a pretty big theatre. Because it has still that beautiful auditorium that Delatour built in 1871. It now seats only just over 1,000, But that's a misleading figure, because between the same walls, because the walls still exist from the beginning, between those walls in its early life, in its first 40 or so years, they used to cram up to 3,400 people, most of them in the gallery.
Terry, thank you very much. That was Terry Coleman, author of the book The Old Vic, The Story of a Great Theatre, From Keane to Olivier to Spacey, and that's out now, published by Faber. And Faber, up next, what can we expect from Hollywood this year?
The idea behind The Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was almost worth $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
With a global network of bureau and correspondents, Monocle has just opened up its newest regional base in the heart of Istanbul. Dedicated to covering the Eastern Mediterranean, Central Asia, and the Middle East, Joseph Dana is our man in Istanbul.
Separated by the Bosphorus Strait and spanning two continents, Istanbul has always been an ideal place to survey the region and make sense of the ever-changing puzzle that is the Middle East. From reports at the Syrian border to commentary from the ground in the Gaza Strip, we have you covered in this rapidly changing patch at the center of the international media.
From Ankara to Almaty, Tel Aviv to Tashkent, Joseph Dana is Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief and our correspondent for the region. Catch his reports on The Globalist and our other daily flagship programmes and across our weekly magazine shows right here on Monocle 24.
Well, Hollywood is looking forward to this year. Analysts are predicting a big year in terms of box office hits after a rather disappointing 2014.
There will be a new Star Wars, a new Bond, a new Jurassic Park, and a new Avengers. As you can notice, these are all sequels or prequels. Where is the original content in Hollywood? To tell us more about what Hollywood has in store for us in 2015, we have film critic and Monocle regular Anna Smith here in the studio. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
And first of all, then, we are in the realm of the sequel. This is presumed by Hollywood to be safe money. This is all about pre-awareness and stuff like this.
Exactly. I mean, ever since kind of the last recession, really, Hollywood's been very, very cautious, doesn't like taking any risks. So as you say, you know, you've got an established audience for something like comic book adaptations. Remakes, very popular. Got another Mad Max remake this year. They'd be remaking Point Break as well. So it's all going
just
on.
Just what everyone wanted.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Dust off the surfboard.
I guess one of the big films to look forward to is the new Bond. We saw some leaks at the end of last year from Sony Pictures, which hinted that there had been some discussion. It might be a bit boring at the end. Let's hope it's not. But are we looking forward to this?
Very much so. I mean, yeah. I mean, they did such a great job with the last one. I'm quite excited about this one. So, and we've also got new Star Wars, of course, which is very exciting, and Mission Impossible 5. So it's, you know, actually there's no reason why sequels, remakes should be bad. Let's not get depressed about it before we've seen them. You know, there might be some really strong stuff out there. I'm hopeful.
It's one of those things we talked about, the sort of the pre-awareness of sort of comic book characters and all the rest of it. Guardians of the Galaxy was one of the kind of surprise hits, I guess, because they were sort of minor Marvel characters of 2014. Where do we go? Are there certain production houses? Are there Universal, the likes of Universal or the likes of Sony of this world that are kind of caught in the sequel's trap? Or are they kind of spread across the board pretty much?
Well, yeah, Universal, you know, Marvel certainly is perhaps guilty of trotting out some of the same old. But you know what? If it's very successful, if it ain't don't break, don't fix, you know. So basically, I think, you know, things like the Avengers with the audience established will be doing very well next year. We've also got some fairy tales like Cinderella. So that's kind of established audience thing, but it's a new take. Kenneth Branagh doing something a little bit different with Cinderella this time, I hope.
I mean, what about the sort of pacing of the year? Most of these big blockbusters come out in the summer. It's all about, it's the sort of type of popcorn date movie or family movie kind of thing. Do the studios have to be very careful when they put the movies out?
Yes, it's very strategic indeed. I mean, at the moment, we've got lots of Oscar contenders, obviously building up to Oscar season, very serious dramas, high quality. Then you've got Easter, you've got more kids' films. Then you've got, of course, the big blockbusters in the summer, and then your Halloween, your horrors. So, yeah, I mean, it is very strategic.
And just tell me that of those other films that we were talking about, there's also an Avengers and a Jurassic Park. Do you feel that actually there is a kind of a loss of some? I know you said that some of these may be great films, but do you think there's a kind of slightly loss of, you know, hope for Hollywood if it can only go back to these old genre films again and again?
I don't feel that necessarily because, you know, we do see a lot of original content. I think the thing to remember is that the sequels and the remakes are actually the ones that get announced first. There's hopefully some stuff coming up later this year that will be very original, very interesting, independent films. They tend to get slated later and slotted in around the big ones.
And then so, we should be looking forward to Sundance and the festival season and seeing what occurs there, I guess.
Yeah, there's always great arts house stuff out there if you want to find it.
We do.
I wanted to ask you about Selma, which I'm quite excited about, the Martin Luther King. Well, it's not necessarily a biography, although it's pretty much about that one march, isn't it? That one, that one part of his life or that one important thing. This is kind of sort of tipped for Oscar greatness. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a window into how your job works as well and what you kind of see fitting into that season and which are the movies that might sort of scoop up some gongs.
Well, I think Selma's a good call. I think David Oyelowo is terrific in it. I think he should be up for Best Actor. Also, Eddie Redmayne in Theory of Everything, the Stephen Hawking biopic, is absolutely terrific. Julianne Moore is my tip for the top for Best Actress for Still Alice. There's a lot of heavyweight contenders this year.
And I wonder whether these big movies, these sort of superhero movies, the sequels and stuff, they pick up a lot of, you know, soundtrack nods. They pick up a lot of, maybe even, you know, kind of production design and these sorts of things.
Visual effects.
But when it comes to actors, it's still the serious dramas, you reckon, that the playing Stephen Hawking as Eddie Redmayne is, for example, that are likely to pick up the gongs.
Very much so. And musicals.
Rather than dressing up as a monster.
Exactly. And the musicals and comedies often suffer, although Into the Woods, I think, might be with a chance this year of a few awards.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a funny thing. How do you kind of apportion your editorial time to each thing? I mean, for every blockbuster that you dutifully go and sit in front of and have to have a point of view about, presumably it's nice for you to be able to uncover something that maybe doesn't have wide distribution and sing the praises of that as well.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be able to champion great British films, for example. This year I loved Pride and sort of told everyone to go and see that, and it was lovely to see that doing quite well as more of a sleeper hit. It's wonderful. You know, I go to see most things that are released every week. So that's, I suppose, sort of between 10 and 12 films at the moment, really. And and it's wonderful to uncover gems as well as write about some that aren't so great. It's just fun watching films and writing about them.
And finally, I just wanted to ask you about distribution. It's an interesting thing. I mean, you know, we watch TV in a very different way. And I think TV is written in a different way for the Netflixes of this word, Netflixes. You know what I mean, of this world, where there are less cliffhangers having to be written into stories. And then cinema seems to have parried that blow by making every film 3 hours long. What's your view on that? Do you think those two go hand in hand? Do you think one's a symptom of the other?
Well, I think my main problem actually with the long films at the moment is splitting one book into two or three parts, as we saw with The Hobbit. Yeah. And we're seeing again this year with The Hunger Games final installment. The last one was a very solid film, but it's so open-ended, it leaves you hanging. Maze Runner as well. So yeah, there's a food guilt. That's probably my biggest bugbear.
Yeah, right. Okay, the splitting.
the splitting. Yes. Give us an ending.
Exactly, give us an ending. Anna Smith, thank you very much for joining us, talking us through the hits, the misses and the maybes, I guess, of the silver screen of 2015. Thank you. And that is it for episode 287 of the Monocle Weekly, the first one of 2015. Andrew, it's quite a good one.
Very good.
Let our listeners decide whether or not it was actually.
I quite like the fact that both the books we talked about today, they're in the same colour. They're both orange. That's quite. They look nice on your shelf, Robert Bound. as you expand your book collection.
No, I think certainly...
And both on an odd way, touch on what it means to be English and the well, as we said, one gave, the old Vic gave birth to the National Theatre and the English kind of gave birth to our National Theatre.
All the world's a stage, the men and women, many players. And I think that's a key part of Robert Toombs's book about the English, is kind of the importance of William Tyndale, William Shakespeare and all the rest of it. Can you think of the third William? Andrew Tuck won't be drawn on it.
Well, no. Another English William. William the First, William the Second, William the Third, William the Fourth. There's four of you. How many would you want? William Defoe.
Any,
I like
Dick,
him.
Any Dick will do.
Okay. Okay.
All right. It's time to stop. Is it?
Yes. It's time to stop.
I can see Andrew's making some sort of rude hand gestures. He wants to stop. It's time to finish.
Okay.
Let's thank our team. Today's show is produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gaia Lutz, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. To play us out this week, we're going to have Kirsty McColl's version of Billy Bragg's New England, as thanks to Robert Toombs. But for now, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.